Just a quick reminder before we get into today's show that if you've not checked out the Intensive Care Academy over at ICU101.com, you should probably think about doing it. That's Brian and my other project. It's a subscriber-based video platform where you can learn all kinds of critical care at your own pace through an app or a website, and I think you'll like it. Lots of great stuff from core content to specialty material, including POCUS stuff, as we're going to talk about on the show today. Check it out if you haven't, ICU101.com. Hey everyone, I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world.
Hello everyone, welcome back to the podcast. Brian Bowling with you as always, and joining me is Brandon Odo.
You.
We're going to talk about some Echo stuff today. Brandon and I are both big POCUS fans. We both use Echo a lot. And I, for one, am always trying to figure out, is there something more I can do with the Echo? Right? You know, the basics and stuff. But Echo, I feel like, is really probably the most useful of all the POCUS things I do in the ICU. And so I'm always kind of like, I'd like to get better with that. So we thought we'd talk about some tips and tricks for getting the most out of your critical care Echo. And we thought we should probably have somebody who knows more than us. Come on. So we invited Mike Lansbaugh. He is in charge of the Critical Care Echo Lab at Intermountain Healthcare in Salt Lake City. Right, Salt Lake?
Yep, Salt Lake City.
So he's going to teach us all about some extra fun Echo stuff for beginners, if you're just learning, or all the way up to advanced stuff. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Mike, can you just tell us briefly about what your practice there looks like? Because your particular role is kind of an interesting mix.
Yeah. Intermountain's a fairly large referral hospital. We have patients coming in from all the way up to the panhandle of Idaho, northeastern Nevada, some of western Colorado. And this is the flagship or the biggest hospital where we end up getting most of the patients. As far as the kind of clinical practice, we've got a group that have of intensivists that do critical care ultrasound and echo. We have a fairly unusual practice in that we've got about five people who have all sat and passed for the standard comprehensive cardiology echo boards. That's the ACE exam or ASE XAM, which is the adult exam. And in addition, we have about three or four of us who also do transesophageal echocardiography as well. And with that critical mass, it leads to a lot of efficiencies in research as well as clinical care. And so our fellows, as well as a lot of the other physicians, get a lot of exposure to that. We do research, we do clinical care, and the advantages of this are that there's, I guess, quite a bit of ultrasound literacy when we talk about it within our group.
Great. Well, you know, ultrasound and maybe especially echo has, you know, been a part of critical care for a long time now, but it really arose in a sort of grassroots way. You know, a lot of people sort of just started doing it, and then the experts they could turn to in a lot of the instruction was often just kind of like the last person to figure it out, you know, the most experienced person in a particular room. And, you know, that's fine, that's great, but it does lead to practices being pretty widespread that in some cases may not be ideal or at least could be better. So today is our opportunity to optimize what everyone is doing, and whether that means correct some common errors or give some tips and just give a kind of a more thoughtful take on some things that a lot of people are probably doing. So I'm going to walk through some of the common types of studies and applications that people are probably doing. But before that, I just want to give you the open floor to share any general tips. Are there common teaching points that you often find are relevant to, you know, most clinicians in the critical care environment, things that are you think commonly being done wrong, kind of high yield stuff that you just like, if you were on an elevator with someone who said that they work in the ICU, you'd be like, hey, listen, just if there's one thing that you're going to do with your ultrasound, you know, do this differently.
Sure. So a couple of the differences in culture. Some people think point of care ultrasound or critical care echo should be an extension of the physical exam and should just be no different than auscultation, meaning no documentation, no billing. I disagree with that. I think that we should hold ourselves to a higher standard. So in general, I think you need to save your images. There are plenty of people who will throw the probe on, take a quick look, make an assessment, make decisions off that, and don't save their images. And so I can think of an example where we pushed thrombolytics for a saddle pulmonary embolism, and that it succeeded. If I had not saved those images, I don't think anyone would have believed me that we actually had a saddle pulmonary embolism, because the CT pulmonary angio that was done shortly afterwards showed no evidence of clot, and this person had a risk for bleeding. Another, I guess, general point I would say, besides saving your image, is that you should complete your exam all the way through. So a lot of people who are trained in, you know, point of care ultrasound or critical care echo learn a basic or abbreviated exam of some sort, whether that's the fate or the feel or the fear, or I mean the clue or the rush. I mean, there's a million, they're all four letter acronyms, but a lot of people will take a look and they say, oh my God, there's tamponade. And then they immediately jump to, well, we got to do something about this rather than completing their exam. I can think of another example where someone had tamponade, and if they had not completed the exam, they would not have realized that the tamponade was related to aortic dissection, which would have prompted a whole different pathway. So you could easily imagine if you don't complete your very basic exam, that can lead to a lot of problems. And then the last bit is, you know, even if you think you know everything, it's like you don't. You should always get expert opinion. And so even at a place like Intermountain, where we have several people who teach at a national level, I mean, I'm still asking my colleagues, hey, what do you think of this? Including people that I've trained, you know, one of the people that I've recently trained, I mean, I think he probably knows more about echo than I do. And so it's like, I've asked him his opinion on a couple of challenging cases. So I think in general, you need to be humble and be able to admit that we don't know everything. And even though seeing appears to be believing, ultrasound doesn't necessarily make you smarter. You can still learn a lot by asking the local expert or a couple of other colleagues.
Very good. Okay, let's talk about some of the things that we can do. And I feel like the most common application in the ICU is probably people evaluating the function of the heart, especially the LV, and asking how it's contracting. Basically, what's the ejection fraction, whether that means in a general sense or trying to actually quantify it. I think probably the majority of the audience is measuring this by eyeballing it. Just get a general gestalt for, is it normalish or moderately reduced or whatever. And I think there's reasonable data that that is generally a method that is sound. Are there, first of all, ways people could do this better, or second of all, times when they should not do it? You know, are there specific cases where people should say, I don't think eyeballing this is a good method, even if it's my general go-to, and I should turn to one of the panoply of other methods of assessing the LV?
Yeah, sure. So when critical care ultrasound and echo was kind of first started or first taught back in the early 2000s, there was a de-emphasis on ejection fraction because there was this perception that you need to really have some familiarity with about 50 to 100 echoes before you feel comfortable measuring this accurately. And so they started to teach things like the E-point septal separation, which is how close the mitral valve gets to the antroseptal septum. And if that number is low, that would suggest good function. The reason they chose that is not because it's the best measurement, but it's because you can reproduce it very easily with 1 hour of training. You know, anyone can measure it. And so there was this belief that EF was just too complicated. And there is some truth to that, in that it does require some, I guess, eyeballing to do an EF. It's a myth to think that the cardiologist is doing an ejection fraction purely objectively. What they do, just like everyone else, is they eyeball an EF and they think this is about 65 or 45 or whatever. They do the tracing. And if that tracing doesn't match up with their preconceived notion, they adjust that tracing slightly to make it conform to what they think the EF actually is. And that's the practice all around the nation. There have been some attempts to do a more, I guess, objective measurement using speckle tracking and automated ejection fraction using artificial intelligence. But in general, the EF is an eyeball technique. And what I would say is if you want to rely on something like that, I think you need to have at least enough exposure to severe, mild, moderate to feel comfortable doing that. For a lot of people, that's somewhere around 50 to 100 echoes of varying contractility. But for the intensivist or the emergency medicine physician, a lot of us don't need to diagnose subtle wall motion abnormality findings. What we need to identify is severe pathology. And in that case, if you can differentiate between mild and moderate versus severe, or if you can distinguish between normal and mild versus moderate and severe, then that's good enough. And I can think of one of my colleagues, Nibris Rugara, who teaches a lot of this. He loves showing a slide where he has his child who looks, I don't know, maybe 10 years old, looking at a bunch of echoes and saying normal, abnormal with no training. And we can all identify normal versus abnormal. As far as some of the pitfalls, though, loading conditions matter. So a lot of times we see someone who's got a high ejection fraction and we think, oh, that must mean good contractility. If this person has low systemic vascular resistance from septic shock, or if they're hypovolemic with low preload, that high ejection fraction may not necessarily correlate with stroke volume. And as, you know, as I say this, that should be something we all know, that stroke volume and ejection fraction are not the same. But it's very easy when people are first starting out to say, hey, ejection fraction's 65%, that must mean everything's good. And we recognize that that's not always the case. Additionally, there's more data to suggest ejection fraction isn't really the best marker of contractility. There's more subtle findings, including strain, none of which I think are really appropriate for the critical care setting as far as at bedside, but it's increasingly being used. And I think it will be within a fairly short time applied at bedside where you'll have an automated strain detection that can detect subtle wall motion abnormalities, may detect problems with contractility that EF wouldn't be able to pick up. Last is you want to recognize how much inotrope or vasopressor is on when you're doing these assessments. I can't tell you how many times I've had a formal echocardiogram done that's read as normal, despite the person being on 1 mic/kg/min of epinephrine, and you have an EF of 55%. That is not normal. That is someone who has a very sick heart. So I think taking into a context all of the other clinical situations or the clinical scenarios is a key when you're trying to interpret ejection fraction. And then last is if you are not on plane, ejection fraction can look very odd. So if you have an ultrasound that is off angle, you can make that EF look bigger or smaller depending on what angle you have, which is why it's so important for most people to try to get imaging from multiple windows and multiple planes. So I almost never rely on a single image. Even though I may be able to get that diagnosis off a single image, I get other images to confirm.
Would you say that it tends to be harder to eyeball also when you have a LV that's not contracting very symmetrically? Either you have some wall motion abnormalities or you know, even the sigmoid septums where it's kind of thicker at the base. I feel like those are cases where it kind of could be hard to, because it's not all one thing. It's a kind of more granular assessment.
Right. Like, you know, as we learn in medical school, you know, these fibers are positioned in multiple orientations. And so there's different types of contraction. But when you look at, let's say, for example, you have a parasternal long axis, you might see that the heart isn't pumping very well. But if you were to do a short axis view, you might see that those two walls may not be pumping as well, but the walls that you might see on an apical four chamber might be pumping just fine. And so that is more prevalent when you see segmental wall motion abnormality. I see it also with, severe hypertrophy too, where you may see some of that. And then you could also have tethering, where one part of the wall is contracting very strongly and the rest of it is just going along for the ride. And if you aren't paying attention, you say, oh, this looks good. And if you take a closer look, you recognize that, well, it's actually that wall is not thickening. It's just being moved. You know, one other aspect of the segmental wall motion abnormality component here is that when you are looking at patients who are tachycardic, you tend to, I think is a common problem where people tend to ascribe that there's more function than there actually is. So when you look at someone who's beating 120 beats per minute, it looks like there's a lot of stuff going on, and it may not actually be an EF of 65. It may actually be 45 or 50, but it's just going so quickly, it's very easy to fool yourself. So this is one of the advantages of recording your image. You can slow it down. You can actually look and see how much contraction is occurring. If you just eyeball it and you don't record it, you may make that mistake.
Right. So, you know, if somebody is questioning their eyeball and they want to try to quantify with some method, and we talked about how quantifying is a lofty word, but to try to use some other technique, what do you think they should be using? I mean, there are so many options. You talked about E-point septal separation. Do you think that's a reasonable kind of a tool in that tool bag, or is it too flawed? Some people, I think, like fractional shortening because it seems also very easy. Or, you know, should we be tracing out and doing like method of discs and things like that? People just say, you know what, there's too many options and they don't add that much. I'm just going to get really good at eyeballing things.
So there's several, several techniques that I think are all useful, but they all have limitations. And fractional shortening and E-point septal separation both have their limitations. For example, if you have mitral stenosis, the E-point septal separation isn't terribly informative about the ventricular function. And if you have segmental wall motion or segmental wall motion abnormality, the fractional shortening isn't terribly informative either. My general advice would be, if you're learning echo and you want to get good at it, you should use the method of discs, trace it out, and compare that to the formal report. You do that for about 50 to 100 echoes until you get a good sense of what's normal and what's abnormal. And I could say the same thing when you talk about valve qualification, when you talk about mild, moderate, or severe regurgitation. There are several objective measurements that can be done, but really what most people do is they eyeball that, and it takes a while to develop your eyeball. And so the way to do that is to compare yourself against professionals. So when I first started, I would do method of discs on every single patient, and I would calculate an EF, and then I would look at what the echo lab had gotten. And sometimes I would recognize that they made errors. They're doing hundreds of echoes a day. They can be sloppy, just like all of us. And sometimes they just said good enough. But I think that would be what I would point to, is if you wanted to capture EF, then you should measure EF. If you want to look for other measures of contractility, there are things in some cases that may be superior to EF and some things that may be inferior. But if you really want to get EF, then the best thing is to train yourself for EF.
Yeah. So, I mean, then it's what's the next thing you could try. And I think it has gotten popular to do Doppler through the LVOT and measure out the VTI, and whether that goes into a full calculation of cardiac output or just kind of using the VTI as a surrogate for the stroke volume, which I feel like might be the most common thing people are doing. I think that this can add something, and particularly in some of the cases we talked about. For instance, maybe the EF is low, but the chamber was really large, so really the stroke volume is reasonable. I think that's the most common thing that it kind of tells you. You're like, wow, it's like 15%, but you know, there's blood coming out of there. What are some of your thoughts and tips? Because I think this is often maybe the first time people are getting into really quantitative Doppler techniques, and therefore there might be a lot of pitfalls just to that whole realm that people are easily falling into.
Sure. When you're using the Doppler to measure LVOT diameter, a couple of things I look for. The velocity time interval.
Yeah, we'll talk diameter in a second.
Yeah. So one is you want to try to get a good waveform. And so one way to assess that is, do you have a nice, you know, a nice band where there's a hollow center and a nice bright rim along that envelope. If that's occurring, you have laminar flow. You are probably getting a good waveform because you are in the middle of a jet and you're not getting a lot of turbulence. If you have a pulse wave Doppler that is kind of filled in, I mean, that's not to say that you can't measure it, but that is a more turbulent waveform. You might not be getting your best tracing. We talk a lot about angle of insonation, or just making sure that your ultrasound is aligned with the jet. And that is important if you want to actually measure cardiac output or stroke volume. But for most of my decisions, I don't really care what the stroke volume is. I don't care what the cardiac output is. What I care about is, did it change? by a certain percentage when I did something. If I add fluid, or if I did a passive leg raise, or if I started a vasopressor, did the cardiac output increase? Did it increase by 10% or 20%? And in that case, even if I'm off angle, if I'm off angle by 10, 20 degrees, as long as I'm off angle consistently between each measurement, that percent change is likely to be, I guess, conserved throughout both measurements. So for a lot of cardiac output measurements, consistency is more important than accuracy. So if I were to do an assessment where I'm going to be doing multiple measurements of the cardiac output or stroke volume, I might even go so far as to get a Sharpie and mark where I put the probe on the chest, and I'm going to do multiple assessments. I would get an apical five-chamber image to make sure that every time I'm doing it, it looks like it's about the same. And even if I'm off angle by 10 degrees or 20 degrees, I still will be consistent as long as I'm always at that same position. Now, if you're within 10, 15 degrees of the true angle of the jet, you're going to be fine because cosine of 15 degrees is 0.97. That means you're maximum only underestimating it by 3%. But the further off you get by angle, the more inaccurate your measurement's going to be. And so I typically don't calculate stroke volume. I use the VTI because I don't want to measure the LVOT diameter multiple times. I measure it once, or I don't measure it at all, because all I care about really is the percent change.
Yeah, I feel like the times when it's most helpful to either measure the actual diameter and do a whole calculation, and oftentimes I'll do something like find their most recent echo and use their measurement because they're going to be more accurate than me, it would be if you're really trying to ask these quantitative questions, like, you know, really the questions you would have been asking in the days when swans were more prevalent, and now, of course, they're uncommon. But, you know, the patient with a bad heart who is septic and you're asking, is there really a flow issue here? Is there cardiogenic shock as well? And not that there's a number that will tell me that, but, you know, if I had a swan and their cardiac index was like 1 versus like 3, I mean, that does mean something to me. And I think you can probably get into a reasonable realm with some of these echo measurements, even if they're sort of wrong. Or if you're trying to interface with somebody else, like a cardiologist, right?
Right.
You could tell them the cardiac output. That's different from saying, you know, the VTI is like 10.
True, although I would say if you had someone who had a cardiac index of 1, I think that's something where, again, a high school student could look at that heart and say that thing is not pumping right. You know, so in defense of the eyeball method, you know, when we talk about quantification, part of the reason all of these things are taught was because of the SWAN. When critical care ultrasound and echo was taught, everyone felt like we got to learn how to calculate cardiac output, and we have to learn how to measure the tricuspid jet regurgitant velocity so we can measure a PA pressure, because those are the two things the SWAN does. And part of the reason the SWAN fell out of favor is because those measurements are not as useful for clinical decision making as we like to think that they are. Now, in some cases they are, but in general critical care, measuring the cardiac index minute to minute isn't necessarily as useful if you have all these other measurements, whether if you can measure blood pressure, if you can see other evidence of perfusion. And the same thing goes where if you already know what the problem is, if you know someone's got pulmonary hypertension due to, from ARDS, well, we don't really need to worry too much about what the pressures are on that. We need to focus on treating the ARDS, and we focus on the ventilator pressures rather than trying to use a vasodilator, for example. So I think a lot of the quantification part came out of this fear of, I need to make sure I know what I'm talking about when I'm addressing a cardiologist, as you said. Mm-hmm. But then it's also taught because, I mean, like everything, people want to sound like an expert. And so, you know, we publish some stuff on diastolic function, and then everyone feels like, oh, I got to learn diastolic function. You publish some stuff on strain, and people say, oh, we got to learn strain. And that's true about VEXIS. That's true about transesophageal lung ultrasound. And part of this is, you know, you have a person who gets academic credit for saying, hey, look what I can do. You know, I'm so smart. I can teach this. You should learn this too. And then you feel like, oh no, I got to learn this as well. I can say a lot of the stuff that's taught in these courses, including courses that I've taught, I think is overkill for what the general, you know, practitioner needs. You know, you can get by with a lot of qualitative assessments to identify severe pathology. As much as I love diastolic function, I think you can do just fine without understanding how to interpret it. And the same thing goes for a lot of other more advanced measurements in ultrasound and echo.
You heard it here, folks. You're trying to measure that thing just like you want to paint flames on the side of your sports car. But, okay, so let's turn to the RV then. I think for a lot of folks, now that we're starting to appreciate maybe the RV is a little more important than we thought, when we ask questions about function, maybe they're saying, eyeball, is it look dilated? Take a look at the septum. Does it look like that's getting flattened out? And then maybe they'll measure a TAPSE. First of all, do you think that's a kind of reasonable take on assessing the RV? And any pitfalls for the TAPSE? Because, you know, it gives you a number, but I don't think people are not as used to troubleshooting that number as they might for some of these other measurements.
Yeah, of course. TAPSE, like every measurement, is attempting to distill this complex system into a single number. And we see problems with that when you talk about some patients who have an adequate TAPSE and they may not actually have good function. I've seen this in patients with group 1 pulmonary arterial hypertension, you know, the classic young woman with severe pulmonary hypertension. They may have a fractional area change that's severely low, or that's a two-dimensional ejection fraction for anyone who doesn't know, but it's essentially a change in the area. And if you were to measure an ejection fraction, it would be low as well, although it's not something that can easily be done without three-dimensional echo or MRI. But their TAPSE looks fine. And why is that? Well, part of that is the TAPSE is tethered to the septum just like the rest of the heart. And if the LV is cranking away, the RV parts of it will also contract. You may have the annulus moving up and down a little bit more than the free wall contracting in and out. Additionally, when you have severe dilation or severe pressure overload, different parts of the heart are going to fail, and it's going to be something where you may see that the free wall doesn't contract as well and the TAPSE does. I've also seen the converse, where the septum isn't really playing much of a role, and the annulus doesn't move as much. The TAPSE's low despite having a fractional area change that's quite high. In fact, we even see that in hypovolemia on the left side. If you have hyperdynamic hypovolemia in the heart, and you look at how the heart contracts, I would wager that you'd probably see a lot more axial or radial contraction than you would longitudinal, meaning that when you're looking at that empty, underfilled heart, the annulus doesn't move up and down nearly as much as the walls moving in and out. You know, and so you might see this heart that goes to near empty. The ventricle walls are nearly touching. They love saying the papillaries are kissing. You know, the walls are touching. And yet that annulus doesn't move up or down nearly as much. And so that might be something where the MAPSE doesn't correlate with EF. And similarly, the TAPSE wouldn't correlate with fractional area change or the EF. In general, I weigh in both. I look at TAPSE. I look at fractional area change. We measure strain in some of our studies, but that's not something that I ever have done at bedside. I think it's not something that's practical, even though now there are plenty of bedside ultrasounds that are capable of measuring these, even though we just don't use it practically. I think of that as kind of looking at a gestalt, and I try to always remember that because the RV wall is so thin, it's going to be susceptible to preload, and it's going to be intolerant of afterload. And so, just like I was mentioning before, you always want to think, what's the clinical context? If I have someone who's got severe, let's say, pressures in the ventilator, what's that going to do to the RV? And what do I anticipate it's going to do? So you want to anticipate that and then think about what does that mean for the RV? If the RV is big and bulging, does that mean that the person's truly fluid overloaded? It may just mean that they've got a pulmonary embolism, or they've got tension pneumothorax or something else that's causing a transient shift of fluid to be more on the right side than the left, rather than true volume overload.
So is a reasonable approach to look at and measure a TAPSE, but also to at least sort of eyeball the overall function of the RV and ask, does the shortening and the movement of the annulus seem to map well to the overall function? Or is it really seem like there's an inconsistency? Like, it's shortening a lot, but the free wall is very weak, or vice versa. And in that case, to say, maybe I'll measure this, but I don't think it's as useful of a measurement.
In general, they correlate pretty well. in that if you have a low TAPSE, you typically have a low fractional area change or a low ejection fraction. It's just we see enough cases where that's not true that we want to at least be mindful of the fact that TAPSE is not the end-all be-all. I think the other thing to be aware of is if you are off angle, TAPSE, which is traditionally measured using M-mode, is not going to be corrected for that. You're going to end up underestimating your TAPSE if the you're using M-mode and you're only measuring it in that one angle. Now, I think Sarah Nikravan and Jose Diaz-Gomez had published a paper showing that you can measure this like even off a subcostal by just using 2D and dragging a line from where the annulus was to where it will be from systole and diastole. They called it the CTAC, and I forget the actual acronym, but it had to do with an assessment of the tricuspid off angle. And there are also machines that will do this for you as well, where you can draw a line and it'll synthesize a new M mode based off this this new angle. But in general, if you're going to use TAPSE, if you're not aligned with the direction of movement, you're going to underestimate it. So that's another thing to be aware of.
Do you think that S prime can add any utility here? I think some people have thought, oh, maybe this adds something to the TAPSE and it's not necessarily harder to get.
Well, so I think S prime has at least been better correlated with one outcomes in some cases. It's been correlated with outcomes in pulmonary hypertension and in heart failure, but also with 3D ejection fraction using MRI. I think one of the challenges with S prime is the same thing with angle. If you're off angle, you're going to have the same sort of underestimates. But one of the big advantages of tissue Doppler is that even when you have poor image quality, tissue Doppler often works really well. So you may have a challenge where you're struggling to see TAPSE because the endocardial border may not be really distinct, but you can put a tissue Doppler there and there and you get a perfectly, you know, bright and well circumscribed signal. And I've used that in the past for the LV as well, where if you have poor visibility, I can sometimes still get a S prime on the ventricular, the LV side for medial or lateral mitral annulus, and similar with TAPSE. So I think S prime offers some information, but in general, it's going to have those same limitations. If you have segmental wall motion abnormality, if you have the tricuspid annulus not behaving like the rest of the heart, or if you're off angle, all of those things can affect your S prime.
Now, and if your S prime is measured off axis, is it going to under or overestimate the value?
Typically, it'll be underestimated, right?
So you'll have a low S prime.
Yes. And that's true for almost any Doppler measurement, right? If you have it perfectly aligned, the calculation should hold true. The more off angle you get, the more you're going to underestimate it. Now, you could theoretically compensate by dividing by cosine of theta, which is whatever the angle is that you're off by. But now you're introducing another potential measurement error where you may not be getting that angle correct. And again, you'd only be measuring it off two dimensions, the screen. It might be actually moving in towards the screen or out of the screen, and you may not be able to capture that. So in general, you're better off just trying to align it as best you can. And if you can get within 15, 20 degrees, it's pretty accurate. Or you just acknowledge, hey, we live in an imperfect world and not everything that I get is going to be perfect. And I'll just have to say good enough is good enough.
I cannot overestimate how introducing the angle of theta to my practice would hurt rather than help it. Okay. Well, do you think there is utility in most cases where maybe someone's asking questions about the RV or, you know, a case like a PE or, you know, the typical shock scenarios in the ICU of measuring the RVSP? So I think it is popular for kind of the reasons you said. It feels like a number that is informative to our care. But in reality, most of the time, I'm not really sure what to do with it. It doesn't seem actionable.
I mean, a lot of what we do is based off tradition. Just like we say, we care about the cardiac output when really we're treating a blood pressure when we talk about interventions in shock, you know, and part of the reason we say we care about the cardiac output is because some physiologists said that's what's important when we had the Swan and we could actually measure it. But I'll tell you, if the Swan had never been invented, we'd just be starting with blood pressure as our main outcome rather than saying, oh, well, cardiac output went up, but blood pressure didn't. The same thing goes for when you're talking about systolic blood pressure in the RV, and you can talk about those limitations as well. If I say the systolic blood pressure is on the right side is, let's say, 95, well, that gives me some information, right? That tells me that that heart is probably used to seeing high blood pressures because my heart isn't going to be able to generate a systolic blood pressure of 95 millimeters of mercury. So, I mean, there is some value in these. And it's also interesting in that if I have a low pressure system, maybe that might make me recognize like, hey, this big blown RV that looks like it's not contracting well, and I can actually get a really good tricuspid jet regurge, and it looks like it's got a pressure of 25. Maybe I might be thinking more of an RV infarct rather than a, you know, pulmonary embolism. But all of these are just kind of more of a Bayesian analysis of trying to show, you know, where my pretest probability is. One challenge when you're trying to interpret tricuspid regurgitation is that the severity of regurg does not correlate with the pressure nearly. You can almost say not at all, right? You can have severe regurg with mild pressure, and you can have mild regurg with severe pressure. In fact, if you have severe regurgitation, that gradient actually will diminish during systole, right? The right atrium gets higher and higher pressures. And so your measurement of the TR jet actually will decrease throughout systole, and you would underestimate the actual RV systolic pressure because you're assuming a central venous pressure or right atrial pressure that's much lower than it actually is at the time of the gradient. And that's another, I guess, caveat, which is the peak-to-peak gradients that we measure on a cath are not occurring at the same time. When we say, hey, RV pressure is let's say it's 70. You got an RV pressure of 70 and my CVP is 10. Okay, well then I would expect that my tricuspid jet regurgitation should be a 60 millimeter of mercury jet. But the problem here is those two measurements that I took are not occurring at the same time. Whereas with echo or ultrasound, I am measuring an instantaneous jet that correlates to maybe at that time systolic pressure was 65 and the right atrial pressure was 5. You know, it could have been a very different picture. So I don't know, in general, I think those numbers are fine when you're looking for extremes, but if you're looking at extremes, you probably don't even need them because there's probably 30 other clues that this person has severe RV failure.
And certainly not helpful in the absence of other data. Like, you know, telling somebody the systemic arterial blood pressure without knowing anything else about the situation, what do I do with that number? It's just a number.
Exactly. Now, if you do have select patients, like for example, if you have certain cardiac patients where you're trying to get like quantification to try to make a decision about whether to start extracorporeal membrane oxygenation or whether or not to evaluate this person for an inhaled vasodilator or something like that, or monitor that. Sure, those numbers might be useful. But I would say for a lot of those, a lot of the people in that field, I don't think trust the echo enough and would still say, I want that Swan to calculate a PAPI. I don't want to rely on the echo. Or I want to actually see the Swan tracings show that the blood pressure has decreased when I start my inhaled nitric. I don't trust the serial echo. And I mean, there is some truth to that too, in that it is a more consistent number that has less interoperator variability.
Okay. Let us speak, perhaps not for too long, on the hot button topic of the IVC. This is maybe the first application a lot of people in the world of resuscitation try to use because it seems easy and it seems to answer a question that they think they have about, basically, should I give this patient fluids? And it's controversial, but let me just get your general take. The most common things people will ask is, how large is the IVC and how much does it collapse during the respiratory cycle? If that were a question that you were to ask, do you think that there are specific cutoff values that should be used? And if so, what are they? Because there are a lot of different numbers you'll see floating around in the literature or in different guidelines, and some of them depend on the circumstance. Or what do you think?
Yeah, so IVC is probably the most commonly performed POCUS assessment. It's probably also the most commonly performed incorrectly. I think of an example of back when POCUS was first in its infancy, you'd see this study from like maybe 2000 that looked at a two-day course, and they showed that ultrasound was useful, provided useful information, and it changed management maybe 25% of patients. There was another study about 10 years later, you know, in the 2010s, that showed that ultrasound changed management in about 50% of patients. And if you looked at it, it was all due to IVC assessments. And one of the challenges with that is if you want to be a purist about the IVC, there's very few patients where it's actually appropriate, right? These, ideally, it should be patients who are passively ventilated, synchronized with the ventilator, taking large tidal volumes. They are patients who don't have ARDS. They don't have abdominal compartment syndrome. They don't have hyperinflation. They have compliant lungs. You know, when we looked at this, in our own ICU, I think there was probably like 10% of fluid challenges where they actually met criteria for vena cava collapsibility. And then there is that study by Coral that and Pro that had suggested that in spontaneously breathing patients, a cutoff of 48%, I just say 50%, seemed to work. But that was using kind of coached breathing. They were taking bigger breaths. When they just said, hey, breathe normally, just breathe like how you're doing now, there were a substantial number of people who were fluid responsive who didn't have much vena cava collapsibility. On top of that, when we talk about what threshold, we really need to say, well, what are we measuring here? Because the original vena cava collapsibility index was the delta, you know, the max minus the min over the maximum. And then there's several that have also looked at maximum minus minimum over the average. And those give you different numbers as well. So if you're talking about that, you end up having a different sort of threshold, whether you're talking about 18% for the when they're doing it over the average, or the maximum was 50%. I think of this as there's a fairly large gray area, but in practice, I usually am around 50% is where I would probably put it. But more important than that is thinking, does this person have the right physiologic state for me to measure vena cava collapsibility? If they're on BiPAP or assisted ventilation, there may not be enough change in your pleural pressure to generate a collapse in the vena cava, even if you are responsive. Now, in practice, if I see someone who has vena cava collapsibility on assisted ventilation, I might be more likely to say that person's fluid responsive. Whereas if they don't have collapse, I would feel less confident about them being not responsive. But in general, I've got about 20 other tests I can do. And so I almost never try to rely on one test. We have a passive leg raise. We can do pulse pressure variation, stroke volume variation. There's several other tests. And there's also the Bayesian approach of, hey, I just gave this guy 4 liters in the past 2 hours. What are the odds that he's still going to be responsive? So that's kind of my take on this. If you want to look at this in more detail, Xavier Monnet, M-O-N-N-E-T, wrote an excellent position piece about all the flaws with vena cava collapsibility a couple years ago, including like tamponade, pulmonary embolism, and all of that. And it talks about some of the potential physiologic states where it may not be applicable.
Sure. So a lot of the confounding states, though, are ones that would reduce variability. So if you find a patient who is on the vent or on non-invasive or something, and you do see substantial variability, you would kind of believe that because it's almost the test has shifted its test characteristics to be, it's less likely that they would have that variability.
Well, yes and no. I mean, that's true for some. But for example, if you have someone who's got severe respiratory effort, you will get collapse. That's not necessarily responsive. If you have someone who's got extremely stiff lungs, like horrible ARDS, and you end up delivering huge pressures into the chest with every breath, that can also be a false positive as well. But you're right. In general, I think a lot of the things that we see, if I see the vena cava collapsing, that makes me think, well, at least there's some venule out there that could be recruited. You know, there's some unstressed volume that I could stress. I don't know if that's necessarily the right thing to do, but,
it's possible.
My general bias on this is prior to ultrasound, our method of assessment was 50% accurate. So I feel like if I'm even 60% accurate, that's a win. And maybe that's not the best way to approach it, but that's how I approach it.
Now, in a spontaneously breathing patient who could understand you, should you ask them to sniff?
Yeah, so the American Society of Echo has used that to try to assess central venous pressure, and it correlates very poorly. The only, I think, really good study on this was by Pro, P-R-E-A-U, which looked at about, close to 100 patients where they were doing this kind of, it wasn't really a sniff, but it was kind of a coached breathing, like, you know, breathing deeper with a metronome kind of thing to see how well someone collapses. The worry with a sniff is you can generate huge amounts of pressure. And I would say that you could take the average person with heart failure. If they sniffed hard enough, you could probably get the thing to collapse just a little bit. And that may not necessarily be where you want to be on that Frank Starling curve.
So that might be what an echo tech is doing as part of their standard evaluation, yes, to approximate the CVP, but it's not necessarily a tool we should use to try to assess fluid responsiveness, because that's probably a different target.
Exactly.
All right, let's talk about valves a little bit. And we talked a little bit about the LVOT VTI already. The other question people sometimes ask here is about dynamic LVOT obstructions, which can, of course, be relevant in shock. Any tips for assessing this? People will usually put like a continuous wave Doppler through the outflow and look for the shape of it and things like that.
Yeah, so I think the shape is really one of the big clues. When you see a continuous wave Doppler and you see a very late peaking kind of stiletto shape rather than that nice bullet or parabolic shape, that gets me much more concerned for dynamic outflow tract obstruction. The other thing is you can also look at the velocities, which will be often through the roof, right? I mean, these will be people whose velocities get really high towards the end of systole, and that's that late peak. But it's just like when you put your finger or your thumb over a hose and you see that velocity just go way, way high. If you were to try to measure a velocity time integral off that, it'd be absurdly high, right? You might get a VTI of 70 or 100. And that doesn't mean that this person's got a stroke volume that's, you know, like 300 or 400. What that means is at that time, when it gets that high, the cross-sectional area that that you're measuring is probably, you know, 0.3 or 0.4 centimeters squared. And so I think the shape of it is a huge clue. The other thing you can do is if you suspect it, you can take a pulse wave Doppler and you can basically march it down from apex to the outflow track. And so if you take a pulse wave Doppler and you'd measure it near the apex, and then you measure it maybe a third of the way down, half the way down, three-fourths of the way down, at some point that velocity will peak. It'll get higher and higher and higher, and then will go down. And that's the area of mid-chamber obstruction. Other things that you might see systolic anterior motion of the mitral valve, also called SAM, where you might see a fairly distinctive thing on color Doppler, where you'll see a jet that looks like it's essentially bifurcating through the this valve, where it's shooting out through the LVOT and into the left atrium, almost like a fork that's you know, a river that's just shooting into two different areas. The other thing too is, I mean, these people, typically on 2D, you can see that they are hyperdynamic, you know, or they have a end systolic volume that's fairly small. So even if you didn't have color Doppler, even if you didn't have pulse wave or continuous wave Doppler, there's still some useful ways to assess that just by 2D.
For the average Joe out here who's evaluating a patient maybe with shock, with their, I was going to say a little sonocyte. I mean, those old things are kind of gone. But, you know, kind of a workaday average POCUS kind of stuff. If you're going to ask if there is clinically significant regurgitation in a valve like the mitral valve or the tricuspid or the aortic valve, I think a lot of people are just sort of eyeballing the valve and maybe they're putting color Doppler and saying, is there an impressive looking jet? And that's about it. Do you think it's reasonable or useful for these people to try to quantify regurgitation any more than that?
No, I don't think quantification is really the name of the game here. I remember one time I was really pleased with myself when I was first training. I was like, oh, I calculated the regurgitant fraction, 30% of their stroke volume is going backwards. And I was patting myself on the back, like, look at this math I did. And I realized, like, well, who cares? It's like the color Doppler shows so much regurgitation. Everyone knows it's severe. And if I said it's severe, or if I said it's severe and 30% is going backwards, who cares? Everyone knows it's severe. I think the value in doing the quantification is to help build up your eyeball. So when you're first learning, you can say, okay, let's measure the vena contracta. Let's measure the jet width. Let's measure the jet area. And we can kind of look at that. And that's okay, that looks like that might be in the mild range or the moderate range. I'll look and see what the expert said. But after a while, you just eyeball it. And what the expert said, I would wager that very few people in the echo lab are sitting there actually measuring the jet area or the vena contracta. They're eyeballing this and saying mild, moderate, or severe. And then if you work at some labs where they are even afraid to commit to that, they'll just say everything is either mild to moderate or moderate to severe, which you shouldn't do. But, you know, that's a common trope as well. I think when you're talking about valves, one of the challenges is a lot of the handheld devices can't do continuous wave Doppler. It's a relatively power intensive form of Doppler. So you're stuck with pulse wave. You're stuck with color Doppler. Some of the newer handheld devices have added this on. And so even if you don't have it, I mean, I can think of one device where it doesn't have continuous wave Doppler, but you could still kind of see a little shadow of this, you know, where you would think that it might be. But in general, the quantification, if you're looking at severe valve stenosis or severe valve regurgitation, you can typically see that with 2D in color. So I think using color is important, but I don't think that I would focus on quantification. I think it's not relevant for the intensivist. The caveat on that, though, is you need to make sure that when you're talking with the cardiologist or the echo tech, they know that you don't know that. I can think of an example where we had someone who had an expert EM doc who was very good at POCUS, and the cardiology or the echo tech said, oh, hey, just so you know, the mitral valve had a 5 millimeter mercury pressure gradient. And he had no idea what that meant. And it wasn't until the patient got up to the ICU that we're like, oh man, this guy mitral stenosis. So one of the challenges here is when we're talking about trying to speak the same language, we want to be able to communicate what our limitations are. And like, if someone says something that you don't understand on that, you just say like, wait, what does that mean? Is a much more useful thing than to just nod and say, okay, sure.
Is that bad? Yeah. So, I mean, stenosis is an interesting question too, because we don't come across a lot of clinically relevant stenotic lesions in the kind of average critical care world. If you're in a, you know, some of the cardiac settings maybe, but the one exception might be really bad aortic stenosis. And that could be, you know, clinically very relevant, but it really, there's not a easy bedside way to assess these. So is there any like low hanging fruit for people who would like just want to know, like, is this patient have like a pinhole of an aortic valve and that might be the reason they're sick or not? Or is this really like, you just got to get someone to come do a proper echo?
Well, I would say whenever you're in doubt, I mean, it's always a good idea to get an expert. And that's true for everything, whether you're talking about ERCP or echo. If you have a high quality two-dimensional image and you can see the valve clearly, and you can clearly see the valve is opening and closing, it's the odds of you having severe stenosis, I think, are pretty low. Now, there's plenty of times where you can have calcification and the valve is opening just fine and you say, I can't tell, right? But if you say, I'm looking and that valve is opening really well and it's a great image, I think you can feel at least somewhat reassured that stenosis is pretty unlikely, at least severe stenosis. And that's really what we care about. If you have mild stenosis, great. Well, that's a problem for the outpatient cardiologist, right? But if you're talking about severe stenosis, most of the patients I've seen with severe stenosis, there is some indication of it on 2D. You have a valve that looks crappy. You have a valve that's calcified or not behaving normally. And then if that's the case, then you say, great, we'll get a formal echo and I'll consult my local expert.
All right, I'm going to give you one more question, which is about diastology. We briefly touched on this, and there's probably a lot more to ask, but I think a lot of people who are getting more into ultrasound, they'll say, oh, there's this whole realm of how the heart relaxes. And then the first thing they'll say is, should I care about, you know, diastolic heart failure? And is this relevant to my patients in shock? And I think a lot of them say, no one really seems to know the relevance of this. And then someone will say, well, you know, you can use some of these measurements to approximate the wedge pressure, which really appeals to a lot of people who grew up with Swans. And that at least might be a number they knew what to do with. What do you think about that practice?
I mean, I love diastolic function, but I'll be the first to tell you that most of the decision-making that you do at the bedside does not need that. I'd say most, not all. There is evidence that you can use diastolic function to help assess excess, just like a wedge, like excess filling pressures. And if you had someone with a high diastolic measurement, a high E to E prime, which would correlate with a high wedge pressure, you might be a little bit more conservative about aggressive fluid management, resuscitation. You might be a bit more aggressive about diuresis. And there's some studies to show that a high E to E prime correlated with failure to successfully extubate someone because they still had pulmonary edema that needed to be removed. There's also a study suggesting low EDE prime correlated with increased hypotension with diuresis. Now, there are better tests, I think, for that than the EDE prime. I would still use a passive leg raise to help gauge for diuresis and tolerance to that. But just like the wedge is not a useless number, the EDE prime is not a useless number. I think there's plenty of times where people say, I want to know what that number is, and they don't really need to know it. I would say, in general, if you have someone who's got poor systolic function, it's really likely that they've got abnormal diastolic function as well. And if you have someone who's got isolated diastolic dysfunction, odds are you probably already knew that. They're someone who with hypertension, they have a prior diagnosis of HFpEF. You already had some idea of that. And then trying to make fluid management decisions based on that. I mean, I've done it, but it's like, there's no data for any of that. I mean, this is something where someone's like, well, I do it because I like it, rather than they're doing it because there's clear evidence that, oh, you need to target a an EDE prime of greater than this or greater than that. And so I think it's cool. I like it. And I would encourage people to learn it because I think it's the gateway drug to learning about more hemodynamics. You do this, and once you figure out how the physiology of that works, everything else in echo starts getting really interesting. But yeah, as far as applying it at bedside, man, you can go your entire life, never learn diastolic function. You'll be a good intensivist. You'll still be okay.
It's like learning to drive a stick. Okay.
I drive a stick, by the way.
Okay. Brian, what else?
what I'm hearing you say, the big takeaway message from this is that math is useless and we shouldn't worry about it. So lots of people are going to be excited about that, I think. But in all seriousness, I think you're right on. I've said this for years that I think when you get into critical care, you have this anticipation that it's going to be lots of calculations and formulas and measurements and figure out this and that. And after you do it for a while, you realize that a lot of it is just trial and error response, right? And I say this all the time with vent settings. Patients will come up from the OR and the respiratory therapist will say, are you okay with the vent settings that I put them on? And my answer is always yes. And they're like, well, you didn't even look at them. I'm like, right, well, because you're not an idiot, right? You put them on something reasonable, we'll just go from there. And I think that this is true. And I think I'm guilty of this in wanting to learn more techniques and learn more things to get more data, because I grew up with Swans. And I think there is some desire to mimic that. But I often come back, like you said, at the end of the day, I go, does it really matter, if I know this exact piece of data, or can I just sort of put a clinical picture together with sort of more basic things? And my time is probably better spent by refining and getting better with basic techniques than it is in learning fancy things. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think there is truth to that. There is also, I guess, the idea of the more we learn about this, the more this changes what that general practice is. The reason we do 6 cc's per kilogram on the vent is because a lot of smart people thought about this and created a study to make it so simple that an idiot can manage a vent, right? I mean, like I can manage a vent with very little effort because I just put it on some basic settings. If you think about ejection fraction, for example, I think probably in the early 2000s, there was a lot of recognition that there was septic myocardial dysfunction was way more prevalent than we anticipated as people started putting the probe on. And we'd say, man, I think there's a lot more dysfunction. And so there's a better recognition that maybe 30 to 60% of patients have some sort of myocardial dysfunction. And that has prompted, I think, an earlier adoption of epinephrine compared to what was used in the 90s. And so when you talk about your one size fits all general sort of protocol, sepsis for dummies sort of thing, that's informed by people who keep pushing the limits. And I mean, I've learned stuff from this that is maybe not necessarily relevant to that patient at bedside, but it informs my understanding of physiology, and that leads to better assessments for other patients as well. So, yeah, I don't think you need to learn this for that one patient, but there's no harm in knowing more about the organs that you're treating.
It's like 90% of the data you get from echoes might not change your care of that patient, but you don't know which percent it's going to be until you
exactly.
look at it all.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's fair.
All right. Final thoughts on this, Mike? Anything you want people to take away about this topic?
Well, one thing I would encourage is we're teaching nurses point of care ultrasound now in our hospital, and I think like this is something where the more people learn it, the better. You're going to end up discovering a lot of things that otherwise wouldn't be picked up. So I'd encourage you, if you are someone who's listening who is not really an ultrasound person, you should do it. And if you are, I would encourage you to try to teach as many people as you can, because I think the more people who learn this, the better care you're going to get for your patients.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us. I think this has been a great review of this topic. I'll just remind everyone, this is just some general educational content, no specific advice for you. And we're not representing our institutions here, just our own thoughts. Talk to you next time.